Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
This week, I'll be talking about abstinence-only education in my home state of Texas, more unhinged homophobia, and ways to bond with your father other than promising him your hymen. Also, an interview with researcher Elizabeth Miller about partner violence and coercing pregnancy. Halloween was a couple weeks ago, I know, but I'm still really amused by both the trend of women wearing slutty costumes and the trend of people wringing their hands about it. I bring it up now because I feel like I found the last word on the trend in this song by Jill Sobule.
Halloween was my favorite holiday, but in these last few years, something so terrible has filled me with fear. It's not the razor in the apple, no, I heard that never happened. No, it's something much worse. It's women whose Halloween costume is just that they're slutty. Well, that's not a costume at all. What happened to witches and monsters? They left the Halloween ball.
Ours is a strange time. More and more opportunities for women to get naked in public, but increasing restrictions to make it hard to do so in private. The right-wing hypocrites are flying down the tube so fast now it's hard to keep up with all of them. Another conservative politician, this time Washington State Representative Richard Curtis, who has voted for anti-gay legislation, was outed for paying male prostitutes for their services. Dan Abrams of MSNBC had an interview with one of the prostitutes, Cody Castanega. This story is funnier than most, funnier even than the stockings or the stethoscope that was part of the sex itself, as you'll see from the interview.
How did you realize that this guy that you had had sex with was actually a lawmaker?
That would be after he gave me his wallet.
Why did he give you his wallet?
Because he didn't have enough money to give me at that time, and so he gave me his wallet as collateral.
And he wasn't paying up the money he owed, and so you started going through his wallet?
No, he gave me he was tired, he didn't want to go down, and he didn't think that he could get that much money at that time in the morning, so he told me to hold on to his wallet until in the morning when he would be able to go and get the remainder of the money that he promised me.
And so it sounds like what he did is he ended up calling the police and claiming that you were trying to extort money from him, right?
Yeah.
And Mr. Bartovi, let me ask you a quick question on that. I mean, you know, it sounds like the reason that this was all sort of came out into the open is because he called the authorities saying, someone's trying to extort money from me, and as a result, this whole investigation ensued, right?
I had a friend who worked for the police department once, and she told me that their favorite calls were from people who'd call in and complain that someone stole their weed. I'm reminded of that now. In other news on the unhinged homophobia front, it looks like the extreme hate monger Fred Phelps, who has a so-called religious website called God Hates Fags, has finally come into some consequences for his hateful behavior. It's kind of a convoluted story, but the basic idea is this. Phelps is singularly obsessed with homosexuality and teaches in his church that America is evil because we have gay men within our borders. In order to spread the word about how evil gay men in America are, Phelps has taken to picketing the funerals of dead soldiers with signs suggesting that these soldiers were killed by God to punish the country for having gay people in it. No, I'm not kidding. He's truly a terrible man, and I'm amazed he has followers, though I shouldn't be. Albert Snyder of York, Pennsylvania sued and won $11 million against Phelps and his church after they picketed the funeral of his son Matthew Snyder, a soldier who died in Iraq. CNN's Rick Sanchez tried to talk to Phelps after the verdict. The interview went poorly.
Why in the world would you do something like that to a father, a good man? You just saw him on our campus.
Oh, hogwash.
Who is grieving the son of... I'm sorry, sir?
You've been brainwashed.
I've been brainwashed.
Yes, talking that way.
What is it?
For goodness sakes, all that was a protestation by the government of the United States against the Word of God. They don't want me preaching. that God is punishing America by killing those servicemen. And if that's why he's doing it and sending them home in body bags, then the appropriate forum of choice would be their funerals. And there's nothing wrong with preaching respectfully at a great distance from the funeral when it's going on.
How, sir, can you call this respectfully when you're using those kinds of words in those signs?
If Sanchez seems hot under the collar, it's because the signs say things like the soldiers are burning in hell and that God gets pleasure out of killing to punish homosexuality. Let's hope that this settlement deprives Phelps and his church of so much money that they can't afford to drive around spreading their hate any longer. Seriously bad news last week. Congress authorized the abstinence-only boondoggle that President Bush wanted, even though they know that it's sexist drivel that puts kids in very real danger. Around the same time, in a darkly funny coincidence, the news came out that not only does the state of Texas lead the nation in teenage births, we also lead the nation in repeat teenage births. That is, one out of four teenage mothers in our state will have at least two children before she comes out of her teen years. Why is this a funny coincidence? Well, it just so happens that Texas is basically the ground zero of this abstinence-only nonsense. Not just the just-say-no philosophy, since that's been around forever and failing forever, but the boondoggle part of it comes out of Texas, along with our former governor George W. Bush. To be fair, Texans have always had a serious problem with sex. I went to high school at what you might call the most progressive time in our state's recent history. Our then-Governor Ann Richards was, after all, the mother of the now-president of Planned Parenthood. And the AIDS crisis had really come home then to privileged straight people, so it seemed more important than ever to push the message about using condoms. But despite all of this, my sex ed experience was pretty weak. We had a couple of weeks in the 7th grade where we mostly talked about periods and what intercourse was, but the most I remember about contraception education was my teacher telling us that if you were on the pill, you have to take it every day and not just when you have sex. In high school health, we had a section on how to brush your teeth, as if 10th graders don't know that, but there was nothing about sex. One teacher of mine, in desperation, took some time out of her completely unrelated course to show us a video on HIV that had explicit instructions on how to use a condom. But that was it. After that, an even more conservative era came in and took hold, and with it came abstinence-only education. The results of all this ignorance and unwillingness to communicate are pretty hard to look away from, but look away Congress did and helped spread the Texas scourge across the U.S. The best take on the problems in Texas is in the movie The Education of Shelby Knox. It's a documentary about a teenage girl in Lubbock, Texas, who takes on the abstinence establishment and pushes for comprehensive sex education, because she's too smart to ignore the obvious, which is Lubbock's high STD and teen pregnancy rates. What I liked about the movie is it really captures the way things are in Texas, where you're getting pious messages about keeping your legs shut in school and in church, but the kids are openly and rather unabashedly behaving differently.
The only thing there is to do in Lubbock is have sex. Drug, sex, rock and roll!
The movie shows how the abstinence-only curricula is a violation of the separation of church and state, because the curricula is all crafted by religious organizations pushing their dogma. In some places, they put a gloss on this to get it by the school boards, but in places like Lubbock, the fundamentalists are bold and have run of the place. The movie follows one, Pastor Ed Ainsworth, and his misanthropy is on full display. This is what he thinks of you and basically all people who have a sexuality, which is most everyone.
Sex is what two dogs do out on the street corner. They just bump and grind a while, boom, 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 and then they go their separate way. But how many of you know in your junior high, in your high school, at your college, there are some young people that are acting like dogs?
Of course, the dog is a noble and kind creature, and I'd far rather look up to a dog as a role model than some Bible-thumping, homophobic misogynist any day. I'd like to welcome Elizabeth Miller to the program. Elizabeth is a researcher at the University of California Davis School of Medicine and has come to us by the way of the Family Violence Prevention Fund to discuss a new study she's done on domestic violence and teen pregnancy. Welcome to RealityCast, Elizabeth.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Can you give me a brief overview of your study on teenage girls and contraception sabotage?
Absolutely. So this is a small study that involved in-depth interviews with 61 girls, all of whom had a known history of being in an abusive relationship with a male partner. They were recruited by domestic violence advocates, adolescent doctors, counselors, nurses. So these were all young women who were already receiving care for this history of abusive relationships. And it was an opportunity to ask the young women to share their stories with us so we could better understand what the chronology of abusive relationships are, how they relate to a young woman's sexual health and contraceptive decision-making, and so forth. And each one of these interviews took about 90 minutes or so, and we asked a whole series of questions related to their health, their sexuality, family violence, their education, substance use, contraception, and so forth, as well as specifics about the abusive relationship, in some cases plural abusive relationships for some of these young women. And what we found was that of those girls, the 53 girls who had repetitive patterns of abuse in relationships, about a quarter of them shared with us that their partner was actively trying to get them pregnant. So in addition to stories about forced sex or condom non-use, the girls also spoke about how their partners would insist that they get pregnant. And that included behaviors like flushing their birth control pills down the toilet, keeping them from getting to clinic to get birth control, poking holes in condoms, removing condoms during sex, and just coercive comments like, you know, honey, we're going to make beautiful babies together. And for some of the girls, this was something they did not want, and they actively tried to hide birth control from their partner. And in other instances, felt much more sort of described it as feeling much more ambivalent, not really wanting to get pregnant, but, you know, ultimately not minding it and so forth. And we thought this was a particularly interesting finding to share with care providers who care for adolescents, because many of us who see adolescents in clinic for birth control and pregnancy testing and so forth don't necessarily think to ask whether the partner is also actively trying to get them pregnant.
Did you find in the interviews information about the motivations of young men who would want to get their partners pregnant at such a young age?
It's an excellent question, and I wish that our interviews were able to really pinpoint that. And, you know, there was some, and I'm only going to call them hints because I don't even have good quotes to pull out to say, well, this is what's going on. I think in some instances, it was just out and out control. So one young woman said, he tried to get me pregnant on purpose and then made me get an abortion. And, you know, in that instance, it was, you know, clearly just control over a young woman's body. In other instances, though, there seemed to be at least some hint of seeking a kind of intimacy or sort of nuclear family that the man and the young woman in this case had not had. So wanting to sort of create the family that neither of them had really experienced. And then there was a third sort of suggestion that these boys just want to have a lot of babies because it adds status. It's essentially a status symbol, in particular for young men who may be gang involved. And we also, in a related study, interviewed a number of young men who were already in young perpetrator programs, the program specifically focused on better intervention for young men. And in those interviews, We were not able to pick up any kind of explanation for explicitly getting their female partners pregnant. And in fact, some of the young men talked about how the girls actively try to trap them with pregnancy. So it's clear that pregnancy is used as a form of control in relationships. The perspectives of men and women clearly differ. And we do need to do a lot more to better understand what the young men's motivations are.
Are you continuing your research in this vein? And if so, what's your next project?
Absolutely. So we have just finished collecting survey data across 5 confidential teen clinics in Boston, 2 of them school-based clinics, 2 of them located in the community, and 1 in a community health center. And what we have found, just as a preliminary look at the data, of a little over 500 girls ages 14 to 20 who we recruited for the study, 40% of these girls describe having ever experienced physical and or sexual violence in a dating relationship. What that means is that young women seeking care in a clinic setting, in a confidential clinic setting, have a two times higher rate of physical and or sexual violence compared to studies at the high school population level. And we've collected information from about 280 boys as well, also seeking clinical care. And what we're hoping to do with that data is really look at some of these questions around sexual and contraceptive decision making. We have a number of items in the survey that actually came out of all of these interviews. So I'm hoping to be able to see something that's more generalizable from the survey data, because given the fact that, you know, interviews are great, but it's a very, very small sample, it's really important to be able to show that these kinds of behaviors and experiences are happening on a much broader scale. So our total sample is somewhere over 800 young people, you know, across the 5 teen clinics in Boston. So I'm hopeful that those findings will really be able to buttress what we're finding. And then I'm also moving into work that focuses more on interventions rather than just describing this phenomenon, which is, you know, certainly incredibly distressing. Of course, the question that comes up is, well, what do we need to do? What are we going to do? So I'm focusing on a number of studies that are clinical interventions. That means studies that are focused on identifying ways to support victims of violence in clinical settings. And we're focusing on family planning clinics and school-based health centers. And some more kind of public health related, I'm also involved in a couple primary prevention programs. One of them, very interesting, that involves recruiting coaches to work with their young male athletes to talk about why sexual harassment, sexualized jokes, and any violence against women and girls is unacceptable, and with hopes of really starting to shift attitudes around masculinity as well.
If you'd like to learn more about this and other research and information on domestic violence, please visit the Family Violence Prevention Fund at endabuse.org. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
Now listen up. Now gather around. Now listen up.
Despite the high creepy factor, purity balls seem to be getting some positive responses out there. People seem sucked in by the rhetoric about how it's a great way for fathers and daughters to bond. On the Tyra Banks show about purity balls, you had women praising purity balls just for this reason.
I think purity ball is something, it's a nice thing to do with your father. It builds a good relationship with your dad. It's a cute idea. It builds trust between the father and a daughter. I think it's a good idea.
And a local NBC affiliate did a positive take on it.
Katie Lamar, now 15, pledged at age 12. She thinks purity balls are good for girls.
It's always good for a dad and a daughter to have a good relationship. And I think that it's good for them to bond over something like that because it just gives them a deeper connection.
Sounds all great, right? Except there's the ew gross factor, which this woman on Tyra Banks' show gets at even though she's trying to be all nice and open-minded about purity balls.
I would not want my father to be involved in my sex life, but if the daughter does want her dad to be involved, I guess that's her own choice.
If you and your dad can't find non-sex related ways to bond, there's a serious problem there. The entire argument for purity balls is based on the wingnut theory that women have sex before marriage because they're broken shells of human beings who long for daddy's love. And here I was thinking it was because we're biologically disposed to get horny. And so if you can lure daddy's attention with a promise to keep your virginity for him, the idea goes, then he'll pay enough attention to his daughter to keep her from caddying around and losing her virginity, which belongs to him, until he gives it away to her husband. Are you creeped out yet? But everyone likes the idea of dads and daughters having a well-bonded relationship. But surely there's ways for fathers and daughters to bond besides giving him symbolic control over her sexuality. With that in mind, as a public service, Reality Cast will now present 5 ways to bond with your father without having to bait him with your hymen. Number 1. Start wearing a large, obnoxious costume around the house. Think Big Bird. When your dad asks what you're doing, act mysterious and try to make him guess. Weird? Yes, but not nearly as weird as signing over your virginity. Number 2. Everyone loves video games, including your dad, even if he doesn't know it yet. What's really great is that if you and your dad need to go slow with the bonding thing, you have that opportunity with video games. You don't even have to be in the same room to play together due to the wonders of online gaming, which makes it the perfect way to ease into the bonding. Number 3. If you need to feel protected by your dad, there's ways to do it without the creepy language about how he's covering you so that other men don't get in with their pokey bits. Join a flag football team with your dad. He can play offensive line and you can be the quarterback. Problem solved. Number 4. If that doesn't make you feel close enough, I have 3 magic words for you. 3-legged race. Number 5. If, for some bizarre reason, you need discussion of naughty bits while bonding with your dad, then you need to go to some pro-choice rallies together. Dads who really care about their daughters want those daughters to have full lives and real rights. How better to show that than hit the streets in a real defense of women and their lives? And now for the wisdom of wingnuts. Max Blumenthal covered the Value Voters Summit a few weeks ago, and as usual with his videos, he's laugh-out-loud funny. So I recommend watching the whole video. But I especially like Star Parker's little rant in it. She's talking less like someone making a point and more like someone reading a bunch of unrelated slogans off a wingnut magic 8-ball.
Abortion now is the number one killer of black women between 25 and 34. We wanted sodomites quarantined.
She's lying, of course. The number one killer of African American women ages 25 to 34 is AIDS. But of course, she'll never admit that, because then it would follow that if you really want to save the lives of black women, you'd support comprehensive sex education and free condoms for everyone.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.